Charlie and a few of their friends chug a couple beers and talk politics. It's better with you two beers in.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Two Beers In, a tipsy political roundtable special Del Close Marathon Edition.
Yes, seltzer edition, not drinking beer because it's early, guys, and we're hungover.
Yeah, so...
So it counts.
My name is Charlie Todd.
I'm Cody Lindquist.
And we host a monthly show at UCB Theater Chelsea called Two Beers In, where we have panelists of comedians and journalists and comedy writers drink two beers and talk about politics.
Yes, and this panel is actually going to be a little bit different. Instead of talking about like what Trump tweeted today, we're going to be discussing just how to do comedy in the age of Trump. So it's a little more evergreen. We're going to talk to some really hilarious comedy writers and ask them about
some of our favorite guests that we've had on the show many times each. We have a murderer's row of political comedy writers here today.
I've never heard that phrase.
Murderer's row?
No. Is that a Southern thing, Charlie?
No. Who's not from the South but knows that phrase? Okay, most of the audience.
No, it's half. It's about half knows it, half doesn't.
I don't think that's Southern.
Is it a beer cozy or a beer koozie?
Koozie! Oh, koozie wins.
Damn you all. It keeps your beer cozy. Anyway.
It's the biggest problem we have with our marriage is we don't agree on
the word
married.
Koozie. Did we say we were married?
We are married.
Yeah.
Yeah.
thanks, guys.
let's bring out the panel. What do you say?
Great.
Coming up first, he's a writer for Late Night with Seth Meyers. You know him as the writer of the Closer Look segments. Give it up for Sal Gentile.
He is a writer-producer for The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, Zubin Parang.
And finally, she is a writer and correspondent for Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. Give it up for Ashley Nicole Black.
Woo! All right, let's squeeze in here and get a little cozy. Get a little cozy with my koozie. I don't have a koozie.
Welcome, guys. We've got two microphones in a special venue, so we have to do a little pass
the mic
today.
So raise your hand if you'd like to speak, and we'll pass it to you. And if you don't raise your hand, you're not going to talk.
First question that we wanted to ask, just it's now been, I guess it's been 18 months of the Trump administration, and we're curious in general if you guys feel like the country is better or worse than you thought it was going to be?
Not better or worse in general, because we know it's worse. I think we can all agree.
No, but I mean, after the election, we all knew it was bad. And the question did it get worse than you thought it was going to be, or has it been about what you expected? And then how have your jobs changed? Like, did you think that it was going to be easier or harder to cover this administration?
Yes. The country is definitely worse than I thought it was going to be. And I was I sobbed election night. I had no hope at all. And I found further depths of hopelessness, which has been interesting for me as a person.
We're all in therapy.
Yeah. when your therapist is also crying, it's like, well, you know, what is there left to do about this? After the election, I thought, like, oh, it'll be interesting to see how Republicans deal with him, because obviously they're not down with all of this or the extremes of this. It'll be interesting to see the back and forth and how, like, people of principle deal with this. And then that just never happened. Like, they have just shown their bellies for everything. As far as the job...
Well, Jeff Flake did make one speech.
He made a speech one time. And there's the occasional tweet. Thanks. Very comforting at night. I just curl up with Jeff Flake and Marco Rubio's principal tweets. the job is the same, I think. It's a little bit more less varied. Like, I think previously, like during the election, there were like 17 people to make fun of, and now it's like just one person. So it can be less varied in that way, but it's basically the same, I think.
I think one thing that makes it very much easier to write for from a comedy perspective is that Trump is such a huge character, and he goes towards all his decisions with such intensity and overreach that it's very easy almost on a daily basis to construct like an entirely different cartoon out of him. I remember, for example, like there was one show, there's one day where it was when, I'm sorry, I'm laughing even thinking about it. It was when it came, when, it was when the Fire and Fury book came out with Michael, when Michael Wolff released that Fire and Fury book. And in it, we discovered that Donald Trump eats a cheeseburger in bed at night and that he's always goes out for McDonald's. And from that, you, like we essentially, we, you can construct like an entire like cheeseburger snorting, like Ronald McDonald addicted a monster. And the next day, he can be super into Space Force, and you can go at him and just construct this like super space nerd enthusiast who wants to go to war in space. It's there's an element of there's a total lack of nuance in him, and there's a complete 100% of whatever that creates an endless supply of cartoon characters that I think is a lot easier to do comedically than it would be if we were making jokes in a Hillary Clinton presidency, which would probably involve a lot more nuance and a lot more like explaining a situation before you can make a joke out of it. And here is just the cheeseburger snorting president, which I think is certainly one of the more aspects of his presidency that makes it easier to deal with the rest of his presidency.
It's easier than making jokes about the fiscal cliff or something like that, like he had to under Obama. Sal?
Hey, Jubin, real quick, though, I'm interested. One thing, you didn't think that he was going to win, and I remember having discussions with you before before the election where you kind of thought he didn't win, and now you sort of feel like he might get 8 years, right? So do you feel, is this worse than you thought it was going to be? Obviously, if he's getting 8 years, it's probably worse.
I mean, yeah, I'll tell you, I will never make a prediction again in my life. I like the day of, I think I texted you and just like laughing at the very idea he was going to win. I was like, the question is if maybe we went in Georgia. So I will never again assume anything that'll ever happen in the future. I'm not even going to buy a house. I'm not even going to assume mortgage level responsibilities of the future. But I think that I'm preparing for 8 years of President Trump because I just don't think and this is more political consideration that is as a comedian. I don't think Democrats really have a good answer to Donald Trump. They don't have anybody who can excite their base the way Donald Trump excites his base, and he is delivering for his base. That, I mean, say what you want about him as a president, but I mean, Kids in Cages is just delicious as a tool for getting your base out. The guy knows what they want. He's doing it for them, so they're going to come out. And I don't know who the Democrats have to come out. So I'm looking forward to at least six more years of cheeseburger president.
Yeah, so I'll agree. So definitely what Zubin was saying is like, it's the fundamental sort of crux of this presidency, which is on the one hand, Trump, absolutely, he gives you new angles all the time. Like his new thing now, he's literally repeating this thing that he's obsessed with that he thinks like rich guys love rockets. So he keeps going around talking about how much rich guys love rockets. And that is like definitely a fun thing to play with. And on the other hand, the curse of the rich guys love rockets thing. It's like, but he keeps doing it over and over. Like every speech now he's given for the past like 3 weeks, he goes into this. It's like he found a new stand-up bit and he rehearsed it enough in front of enough audiences and it worked. So now he just does it. And it's like now you've seen the stand-up comic do this, his set the 10th time. You're like, all right, fine. And it's hard to come up with a new take on that. Like the 100th time he claims that he's accomplished more in his presidency in the first 100 days or whatever than any president has ever in the entirety of their administration, that is harder to say something new about. In terms of the question of like whether it's better or worse, you know, on the one hand, I like similarly, I think as with we probably all were in like a deep depression for like however many days after the election, I had recurring fears and I was certain that we would all die in like a hellfire, like a nuclear war. So at least that hasn't happened yet. It definitely, here's the thing though. Yeah. See, so we're all alive. Yeah. But I think what's happening now, if it wasn't already clear that the crisis that everyone feared was happening already, it's definitely happening now. I mean, so in that sense, like, and the other thing you were talking about Republicans, like the worst part of it, I think, is like people are now realizing, you know, people just assumed there are like things that there are rules or there are like institutions that stop certain things from happening. And this presidency has proven that there is no such thing. Like, there is only politics. And so that, I guess, goes in the worst camp in the sense that everyone's realizing now that there is literally nothing to stop Trump other than people on the other side organizing and mobilizing. Like, that's it. That's the only thing to stop him.
And this is sort of along those lines of things being better or worse. I think we can all agree things are tough. I mean, all of us liberal Hollywood elites. How do you continue to make jokes when you're faced with things that are so bleak? You know, I've just had a kid, and it's like I can't even watch the children being separated at the border. And like on a smaller scale, Charlie and I have a monthly show and a political show, and we're having a hard time like keeping it light and funny. So how do you every day when you're faced with things that are so bleak, how do you make a comedy show out of it and also educate people?
Okay. Well, I'm just mentally ill, so that helps. Like, just the thing where, like, when you... just mentally ill as a human being. So I think my natural response to something terrible is to make a joke, and that's how I ended up here. It is definitely much harder, I think, particularly around immigration, because it's like, who... It's almost offensive that we even have to, like, at one of the base things about comedy is that it's about persuading people of something, right? So either you're telling your story, or if it's political, you're like, here's my political opinion, and it is, you're building a persuasive argument in the silliest way possible. But to have to persuade about children being taken from their parents is so offensive at its base that it's hard to even build. What argument do you build other than what the fuck is wrong with you, and which is not a joke? So it is very difficult.
I think that if you're a comedian, your natural instinct is to make jokes about anything, no matter how bad you personally think it is. And also the fact that my salary depends on it is a very good motivator to make jokes about things. I think that, maybe just as a comedian, like what Ashley was saying, like it's, I don't think there's anything that is so horrible that I couldn't think of a joke around it. So, and like Ashley, that's how you deal with a lot of stuff that upsets you. So I would say the worse it gets, the better I react. So I don't think I'm hoping it gets a lot worse. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It's definitely a challenge. I just feel like, you know, especially the past couple of weeks, with the family separation policy, policy and the children in cages. Jesus. just saying it out loud as a reminder of how awful it is. You walk around angry all day, and you watch TV and you're angry all day, and you read the news and you're angry all day, and I feel that very viscerally. So on the one hand, it's very cathartic to channel that through comedy, as these guys have said already. So at the very least, you just allow yourself to do that. Like, I don't think we've gotten to a point now where we don't feel like we have to filter ourselves. Like, if we're angry about something, we're definitely going to channel that through comedy. And, you know, it's hard to write jokes about it, but you do it. But, you know, at the very least, I think at this point we've dispensed with any idea that we have to filter our emotions or, you know, see how things play out. At this point, it's like, if we're feeling angry, that's because these things are horrifying, and so let's just find the best way we can to make comedy about it, and it'll be cathartic for us and the audience.
Let me actually add on to that, too, because I do think that there is you also want to resist a tendency to, just as a comedian, to replace your the process by which you make jokes with emotion, because it's very easy, especially in this political environment, to overcorrect in the other direction. And actually, the family separation policy the last month is a lesson in that. Before, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, people on the left began circulating these photos that everyone thought was happening in the moment, but then turned out to be happening in the Obama administration. And if you reacted immediately to that without taking a moment to like think through it, to like check yourself, to go through the usual process you have about of making jokes, you ended up looking foolish and not being productive to anybody. And not to mention opening up a line of attack for people on the opposing side to call into question your objectivity, your ability to present truth. So I think you have to, more than ever, in times when you personally feel emotionally involved in what's going on, you have to stick to your process and distance yourself enough in your work that you can approach the situation objectively enough to make a joke about it.
Yeah, that one. It's interesting you bring that up because I feel like we've all gotten very skeptical. Just the stuff that happens in the Trump administration is so absurd that I feel like I have to wait until like three credible news sources say it happened before I believe it. The most recent example was when Melania Trump was wearing that jacket. I was like, oh, that's an Onion article. Like, that's, I am not going to fall for that. I'm not some liberal snowflake falling for that bullshit. And then New York Times was put the picture out. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? This is true. So yeah, I mean, it is definitely like, I think we're all very much on heightened. Like, I want to be factually correct. Because I feel like, not that it matters anymore, but you know, it does feel like, important to make that happen.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Oh, I just want to say it doesn't matter. You should definitely do that and you should only spread information that you know to be true. But, we did a segment where we showed those pictures and talked about how they were from 2014, from during the Obama administration. But the difference was during the Obama administration, children were coming unaccompanied, and so they already didn't have parents with them. And the difference with what Trump is doing now is he's taking them away from their parents. And every single comment was, well, Obama really did this. And it's like, oh, yeah, there's no point in like trying to please people who were never going to listen to you anyway. Like, be right, because it's the right thing to do. But don't think, I think liberals have to get over thinking if we're right enough, they're going to give up. They don't care that you're right. There's no being right enough to win.
I was just going to say, this is definitely the case with this administration, that it is constantly presenting just a sort of like an ever-present challenge to your like your judgment about what's real and what's not. Like, I remember I have it was like an hour before we tape our show, or 45 minutes or something like that. And I was coming up from, there's like a different floor where I go and just kind of make sure like all the sort of graphics and clips and everything that are in our pieces are all right. And I was coming up from that floor, I was coming back to our studio. And I just remember another writer was just like hanging out by like the studio, and he was like, hey, did you see the shithole thing? And I was like, I just thought he was joking. Like, I just thought it was a joke about like, oh, Trump, you know, pulled his pants down and showed his shithole to everyone. Like, I just thought he was kidding. And I was like, I started laughing. I was like, yeah, oh man, the shithole. He's like, no, like, go read the news. Like, Trump called.
And in that moment, are you like, fuck, everything I wrote for today is
Before he finished his sentence, I started sprinting down to the other end of the hall to my desk. I was like, no!
That's got to be exhausting for you guys. I feel like you spend all day working on a show, and then Trump is, like, constantly changing the story 5 minutes before you go to tape.
Yes. Yeah. It's actually amazing how we've adapted to it. Like, comedy was not, I don't know, maybe if you guys can remember a time before this, there was no time where comedy also had to have like rapid response, like capabilities to be like, oh, we got to be able to write a joke about this thing that happened in the last half hour and like get a clip package together to explain it and all these things. And like, there was never a time when that was necessary. So late night shows never really, Jubin, you might have a different perspective on this from the years before Trump, but like, I never really had the perception that like, oh, late night shows before this had to deal with news that broke half an hour before the taping of the show.
No, it never was this bad. Like, I remember I was a writer on The Daily Show in the Jon Stewart era before Trump. And in 2012, we would feel very comfortable waiting a day or two before addressing any news story of the day. I remember we would have, during the 2012 conventions, we would talk about the big speeches the next night. So, you know, like Mitt Romney would speak at 10 o'clock on Thursday night. We would address it at 11 o'clock on Friday night. And that 24-hour gap is a joke now. The idea that we would, this has happened in this era, we would already have ignored it in favor of whatever just happened now. The speed with which news happens now is utterly exhausting.
Also, like, historically, comedy wasn't built for that. Like, Now, I think Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock, they have people lock up their cell phones when they do sets so people can't, like, release stuff too soon. And people are like, that's crazy. But back in the day, dudes would write one stand-up routine, and they would do it for 10 years. And then when you finally got on TV, then you had to write a new routine. And that's what they would do. And that's how long it takes sometimes to hone a joke. And now we're literally like, this happened a half hour ago. Write the perfect joke and don't get in trouble. It's insane.
I'm curious about the speed of news and the speed of commentary, because not only are you guys having to, like, update your jokes for that night, but you also have the situation where everybody is tweeting out their jokes, like, immediately. Like, before you had read the shithole news story, there had already been, you know, 1,000 amateur comedians or professional comedians who've made their own shithole joke on Twitter, not to mention that there's now, you know, 10 shows in the genre of the shows that you guys do. And I'm curious, like, if you watch each other's shows, or if you sort of, if there's people on staff who check to see if a joke has already been done by, you know, John Oliver the night before, or if you check Twitter, or if it's just...
Yes, Sal, you just go to Twitter and get all the jokes, right? You steal them.
Yeah. No, I feel like we are immune to consequences. And don't, like, just... And if you think we stole a joke, just please be civil, okay? Don't ever, like, you know? But so, no, I mean, it depends on the situation. You're totally right. We make sure to watch. I watch all the other shows as much as I can, just make sure, especially when we're talking about the same things, that we're not making the same jokes. And other people on staff do as well. And people will flag it. Like, if there's something, it's like, oh, this something similar. They did something similar on The Daily Show, or Oliver did something similar last night. Or at the very least, if we're talking about the same thing, it's like, hey, I think Oliver or The Daily Show or Sam B did a piece on this last night. Like, just check it and make sure, like, nothing seems similar. On the other hand, if it's like you have half an hour to write a joke, you really don't have time to be precious about it or make a choice, like, put it through much of a filter at all. You have to come up with a couple ideas and just pick one.
Ashley, do you since you guys are weekly, is it more difficult for you in some ways? Because I feel like you put all this work in throughout the whole week, and then everything changes really quickly. I mean, I don't know. Do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, it's a little bit different for us because most of the other hosts are men. So our...
Wait, what?
I don't know. It's hard to notice. Most of the other hosts are all wearing Brooks Brothers. As a matter, they're all wearing the same suit. So our act two is the one that we start ahead of time, and it's usually not as topical, and usually no one else is covering that thing because it's vagina time 90% of the time. Yeah. We're talking about what makes women sad. We did do a whole piece on endometriosis. and then our act one is usually more topical, and then we're not that far away from the daily shows because we start writing it Monday or Tuesday, and then, yeah, we're all hitting the air. I think we're a half hour before the other shows. So, yeah, sometimes you're all going to say the same stuff, and that's fine.
I do the difference between us and Twitter jokes is that we have the ability to construct a lengthier story, if not an argument, over the course of, like, 8 minutes, and Twitter only has that immediate reaction joke, you know, monologue-y style punchline.
It's really crazy that you say that, because that means that the president is using, like, it's really hard to get all that across in a tiny tweet, and that's why we're having policy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Decided.
That's why if we had any brains, we'd make these arguments on Twitter where the president can absorb them. It would be a lot more functional for our democracy if we had Twitter arguments. But I think that because that's what we lean into at least. We don't really pay attention that much to Twitter because those jokes are in the same style and format as our jokes. And the same way, like with Ashley and with Sam and with Seth and with Oliver, all of these voices are different, and we lean into Trevor's own perspective and voice, and that's how we differentiate ourselves just from each other and from Twitter. So I think we are almost always going to end up saying maybe the same one-liner as one of else did, or as, you know, a Twitter thing. And we have people on staff who watch all the shows to make sure we don't do anything that's like someone else has like kind of already done. But we're not that worried about it because our style is so much different from Twitter and from each other.
I'm always sort of like, sort of pleasantly surprised by and impressed by how different all of the shows are, which is a good thing because like, if they were all saying the exact same thing, that'd be a problem. Everyone has different perspectives that they bring to it and different life experiences and different comedic sensibilities and different takes. So I'm always sort of pleasantly surprised and impressed by how rarely it is the case that, like, two people say the same thing or whatever. And again, Shubin's right. Like, occasionally there will be sort of a one-line or just something like that that may sound similar. But other than that, it's really sort of like I'm always consistently and if anything, I just end up watching the shows because I'm like, oh, I enjoyed that other take that that other show had that we didn't have, which is like more often the case than watching it and being like, oh, they did the same thing or something like that.
I'm curious if you guys know what percentage of your audience is watching, you know, the entire 44 minutes or 22 minutes, and what percentage is watching clips on YouTube or Twitter. Like, as TV is changing, are you finding that the content you're making, its main audience is the next day on Twitter rather than live or DVR? And if so, does that change the way you write it all, where do you try to create, you know, a segment that might have the potential to blow up online?
I'm not actually completely sure. I know that data exists, but in terms of how it affects my writing, our segments are sort of in social media-sized chunks anyway with our first and second act, so I don't know if we would lean into it differently if I had different information about it. I think that I don't know what percentage of our audience watches what part of the TV show versus Twitter. I know that, like, more and more people watch our shows on social media, and I think that that only increases the urgency of the comedy. They need to be up to date. They need to be on top of that news cycle, because if people are not going to be tweeting out your show 7 hours after it airs, much less the next day and a day and a half after that for it to come up online. So that it definitely heightens the urgency, I would say, but I don't know if it affects... I don't know. I don't go into it thinking, like, how can I make this... how can I get 25,000 retweets on this joke?
Only because we did an act about Facebook, and so one of the things we researched was how Facebook affects content creators. Do we know that a lot more people watch our show on Facebook than maybe anywhere else? But I don't think it affects how we write, because, you know, like you said, our act one and twos are two different acts, and that's how they go out on Facebook. Very rarely, I want to say maybe like three times in the history of the show, we've done an act one and act two on the same topic. But the reason we don't do that very often is not because they're going to travel separately online. It's just because nobody wants to talk about any of the things that are happening in the world right now for 14 minutes. Like, everything is just so sad that it's like, how can we cut this down to 7 minutes and get as many jokes in there as possible? But yeah, it's already kind of sized to travel, I think.
Yeah, it occurred to me when you were asking this that I was like, this might be information that I would have the capacity for in, like, a different era. Like, I'd be, like, looking at, oh, our audience retention from the first act to the second act is this percent, and, like, this demo is watching this act. And now it's like we're all just constantly running around and opening our mouths and waiting for the hose of shit to just pour itself in. So, like, I have no idea. But I do definitely – late-night shows are interesting in that they are sort of built – but without this intention, but they are this to be sort of like these little sort of segment delivery vehicles. It just happens to be this situation where it's a show that's built for all the little pieces to exist on their own. So that just naturally happens. I mean, I definitely know that there are people, lots of people, who watch Closer Look who may not necessarily watch the whole show. I mean, I know people say to me all the time, it's like, oh, I watch Closer Look in the morning, you know, or something like that. Yeah. So it's, you know, so there's that definitely is the case. So, you know, and that's just probably how it's going to be. Fun. But, like, it's interesting how late night shows are just sort of built for that. And is one way, it's one of the reasons why I think they've sort of thrived in why is this happening to me right now?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's too hot.
It's like 120 degrees outside.
I quit on this sentence. I just stopped.
Same way. I do think it is. Although, having brought up Facebook, Ashley, it is interesting how terrible social media has been, not for the late shows necessarily, but for comedy as a whole. You're seeing now with the implosion of all these online comedy sites like Above Average and Funny or Die, how Facebook's Facebook's native player and its news feed has really drained out a lot of the unique voices on the internet. What used to be a series of different websites that would be able to find advertisers for their own content have now all been sucked up by Facebook. And Jared, Charlie, you probably know this in a much more
specific way. Yeah, no, I mean, definitely Facebook helped ruin the internet.
100%.
And algorithms sort of ruin the internet. But, you know, part of, I mean, this is kind of off topic, but I feel like, you know, maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, there was a lot of independent creators making things, and including me. And you'd go to, like the front page of YouTube was, like, the goal of any video that I made for Improv Everywhere was to get in that front page and, like, trending or whatever. It used to be I was competing with other people like me who are working on a shoestring budget, you know, just like weird YouTubers like Shane Dawson or Ray William Johnson or, you know, names that most people don't even know. And then all of a sudden, really Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, I think, was the first show that they started putting every clip onto YouTube. And then, you know, 5 years go by, and if you go to that front page of YouTube, it's a lot of your shows. I mean, it's so independent content creators are having to compete against people who have, you know, a television show they're churning out four things a week. So it's your fault. You guys helped bring that. But I think what Sal what you said, Sal, I think is totally right, is that the late night, the YouTube in particular has favored its algorithm to, tweaked its algorithm to favor content that's like daily. And like what the late night shows have, at least the nightly late night shows, is every day there's five clips. So people watch, and then like when I show up on YouTube with my phone, it's going to show me a closer look first, and then it'll show me a Trevor Noah clip, and it'll show me a Sam B clip. And it's because, you know, it knows that's what I want.
That's actually interesting. I thought YouTube was the best one of these things, because the Facebook, my understanding is the monetization of Facebook completely rubs almost all sharing of
Facebook has completely destroyed the internet in bigger, more profound ways.
Yeah, wow.
And YouTube also has revenue share and pays creators, which Facebook has yet to really
right.
do.
That I thought was at least something.
Oh yeah, it's something. Yeah.
I just have to say this story because it's really funny to me. So, you know, Diamond and Silk testified in front of Congress, and they testified that
They're two innocent YouTubers, right? They're conservative African-American YouTubers, is that right?
They're pro-Trump YouTubers. Okay. I think most of these people were Democrats until they saw how much more money could be made by being pro-Trump.
Wow. But
they said, you know, we used to have millions and millions of followers on Facebook, and then all of a sudden they disappeared. Facebook is destroying conservative voices. Well, actually what Facebook did was destroyed everyone.
Yep.
But they assumed that it was just really personal to them, which is like a certain level of narcissism, but also maybe because they don't have a lot of friends who are other content creators, they didn't realize that like Facebook is hurting everyone who's putting their stuff on Facebook. They're not targeting conservatives.
Yeah, no, everybody's gone off the cliff, from the little guy size companies to, you know, big the New York Times.
So one of the ways that you're different, obviously, than independent content creators is you have networks to answer to. And so I'm interested to hear if you guys have to tailor any of your content based on the networks you're on. You're all on different networks, or do you get free rein to do whatever you want? Just interested to know. Is anyone going to out their network right now for telling them not to do something? But
say I am blissfully uninvolved in any network level conversation, so I will pass the mic to someone more important.
I'm not more important. I don't know why you passed the mic to me, but we the network airs us. The network has the right to object to certain things we say. We have the standard concerns whenever we want to outright insult a product that happens to be one of our sponsors. If we say something, if we make a factual assertion, they want to make sure it's accurate, which I learn when I write a joke to make fun of them. I then learn that that product sponsors us. So then I learn it by making fun of them, and then I'm told that I can't do that.
Can you talk about Arby's a little bit?
So. No, I cannot.
They're a great product. But I'm actually asking because you guys went from just arbitrarily making fun of Arby's to them sort of embracing it, and then they actually do sponsor the show.
In the Jon Stewart era, John would make fun of Arby's, partly because Arby's was one of our non-sponsors, so they were open to be made fun of. But it became such a big recurring bit that Arby's leaned into the joke and ended up sponsoring us. And like our last show, they offered John an application form for him to apply for a job at Arby's, which was very classy of Arby's. It was really funny, good response. Also, I genuinely also like Arby's, and I'm not saying this separately. Every time he would make fun of Arby's back then, I remember being like, oh, Arby's isn't that bad. I like Arby's. That kind of depends on like how cool the social media team that runs these companies are. Right. There are some companies that even if we make a joke that tangentially hits them, not even insults their product, but like talks about the product on the way to making fun of something else, they don't even want a piece of that. And, you know, our network airs us. We are all here cogs in a capitalist machine that seeks to advance its profits by means of making jokes to a consuming public, so they have every right to do that. To my knowledge, we have never been told, like, don't make this joke, even though it's accurate, for some sort of, like, political concern the network has had. So that's at least a mark in the favor of Viacom Incorporated.
Sal, I'm curious if anything is different being on a network, being on NBC versus cable.
Unlike these bullshit cable networks that these assholes work for.
Yeah, wow. pay TV. You don't get it through an antenna on your. Wow. I have absolutely no involvement or awareness at all of any sort of conversations with executives. There's never been a case where anyone said, I don't even know about the sponsors things. Like, I've never even heard of, like, we had a joke about some fast food chain or whatever. In fact, I'm shocked. You guys, like, essentially, like, negged Arby's into, like, liking you. You should, yeah. It's pretty awesome.
Hey, guys, do you all know, too, that Arby's is called Arby's because RB, roast beef?
What?
Yes.
No.
Isn't that mind blown, everyone? Charlie and I used to go on dates to Arby's, and we get two fries and two roast beefs for $5. Very romantic.
Also, Arby's is also sponsoring this panel
as
well.
Yeah, it is. Like, it is.
They follow Jubin around wherever
everyone,
he goes.
Everyone, look under your seats. Arby's for everyone. But anyway, Charlie told me that, and I was like, let's get married. You're the smartest person I've ever met. Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted everyone to know that your minds are blown.
No, in fact, the other day we were laughing because we saw some dudes like I don't even see people like in suits ever anywhere. Like I just, and anytime somebody's like we were just kind of around the office, we saw some people, it turned out some office construction was happening or something, so people, but like nicely dressed men were like walking around like sizing things up, and we were joking like, is this one of those like movies where they just sort of secretly, is this like a Truman Show thing, or like they secretly remove somebody and don't tell anybody, like why are these suits here? Like, so I never see suits, I never like talk to an executive ever, like I've never heard of a situation where anything was like ever a problem or anything like that. And if it probably was, it would probably be above my head. And you know,
are there any different standards though, being a network? Like, there's dirty words that they can say that you can't say, even down to that level?
Yes, we do. We have FCC all over our asses. I'm vaguely aware of this, but I think it like changes the rating of the show. For example, if we drop an F-bomb or something like that, and obviously it's bleeped. Whereas like some words are not bleeped for you guys, right? Like, can you say shit or that kind of thing?
Shit.
Yeah, like we can't. Everything like that is bleeped. Even there are conversations sometimes, and like there are certain contexts in which we're allowed to say dick, and others in which it has to be bleeped.
What happens if you're playing a clip that the president has said? If you're saying pussy, does that have to be bleeped?
Yeah. It has to be bleeped, I think, but I'm not 100% sure. I'm trying to remember.
Welcome to America, guys. Yeah, Happy July 4th, everyone.
Yeah.
So in that vein, how do you stop yourselves sometimes from going too far, or is there a too far to go in the comedy world? Silence. Crickets. I just mean, what is too far in the age of Trump? Is there too far, and then how do you stop yourself?
I mean, I think that's a personal question, I think, ultimately, for any comedian. If someone else is putting you on the air, then obviously that question also involves them. But I think certain principles, I think, generally apply. Like, you don't want to go after powerless people, like kids. I think in terms of what you can say about people in power, I personally have almost no limits on that. I don't think people in power deserve any respect when it comes to what you can say about them or to them. I think that's ultimately a personal question. And I think that I also respect the fact that some comedians want to go a lot farther. That's their right to say it. And if they build a following that way, there's people that want to hear that. That's on them.
I think it's a really tough question right now. I totally agree. For me, it's kind of like, as long as you're punching up, you're doing fine. There's this question now of like, we're supposed to go high, like they go low, we go high, we're supposed to be better and more civil with them, which sounds lovely, but appears to be a losing strategy. So I think it's kind of an open question for comedians and for like regular people. Like when someone is legit jailing children, do you up your response to match that crazy, or do you politely ask them not to? Neither of those seem to work. So, you know, do you just make fun of them more? That's what we're doing. It doesn't seem like you can really hurt these people, though. We call them ugly a lot, and they're not like they're not slowing down. So it's tough. It's really tough.
But would you say that's a purpose of the comedy? I guess I wonder sometimes. Like I always hesitate to try to blur your role as a comedian versus your role as you know, as a private citizen interested in political action. And I guess I don't know if we have a different opinion on this, whether or not a comedian making fun of a politician is meant to change that politician or just to be funny.
I think not to change them. So me personally, I'm still like the little kid on the playground who's like, you hurt my feelings, I'm going to be mean to you, and I want you to leave crying. That's not like a political thing. That's just like a human, like, you're a bad person, I want you to feel bad about yourself. But I think it's, I have always been really resistant to, because, you know, like, I'm sure you guys get, like, every time you get interviewed, it's like, so you're an activist. And I'm like, no, activists are outside. We're in an air-conditioned studio. It's like two very different things. We're comedians. We're here to make people laugh. But no matter how much you say that, people just don't believe it anymore. And like the RNC put out a video where they were like, the left is unhinged, but the people they were quoting were comedians. So they're now just equating us with Congress people, which is incorrect. But also you kind of have to, if that's how people are going to view you, you have to acknowledge that, I guess. I don't know.
Your parents can be so proud. You guys are senators now.
It's also so dumb because imagine how like different things would be if, like, first of all, imagine that the comedians actually have any sort of institutional political power. Like, there are actually people in positions of power, you know, in the Democratic Party and stuff. And like comedians, like, first of all, imagine how much more the Democratic Party would be talking about Arby's if comedians were in power. Like, we'd be, you know, so things that's just so silly. But like, look, I think we were talking about this before, like, there are some things that are at least very clarified now, which is like, for example, this civility conversation that's happening. Like, what people are learning now, that civility just means when the people, especially when the people who say it ask to be treated civilly, what it means is just deference to power. And comedians have never, should not be deferential to power, as Zubin was saying before. Like, people in positions of power are owed no deference or civility whatsoever. So that's always been the case with comedy. It's just more barbed now because it's become clearer what civility really means, like, and what those people are really asking for. They're just asking for immunity from consequences. And so, you know, they get more upset now when comedians make fun of them, or when, more importantly, activists challenge them, because they're used to having their actions be free from consequences.
Well, and the level of consequence they want to be free, they don't even want to have their dinner interrupted, is how sensitive they are to even the possibility that what they decide about other people's lives might somehow affect them in the slightest moment of their own. But it's amazing.
I think this goes back to this idea that we have, you know, on the internet, that there's this level of that you're removed, right, from consequences. You know, it's this problem that we're having now with social media where I can, like, at reply, you know, Sal and be like, Sal, you're a piece of shit, you know, and then just go about my day. But Sal reads that, you know what I mean? Like, I would never go up to Sal in public and say, Sal, you're a piece of shit, but I feel like I'm able to do it online, right? Like, even though he's reading it, it just feels like this level of, like, personal responsibility is gone. And it is interesting to me that like someone like Sarah Huckabee Sanders can get up all day long and spout lies, but when someone comes up to her in person, looks at her face and says, I don't like what you're doing and I'd like you to leave, then it's like, whoa, what? You know, because we're not faced with these consequences. People aren't in our face. You know, we live in a fake life now. We don't live in real life having a conversation with somebody. So
it was a very weird way to ask me to do this panel, to tweet at me and call me a piece of shit.
I don't know why I picked you specifically.
Hey, you piece of shit. Come do this panel on Sunday too.
Yeah. It was weird. I was like, that is how we became friends. I just at replied all of you really nasty things.
One thing I wanted to bring up, I mean, I think a moment of incivility, quote unquote, that we saw was at the Correspondents' Dinner this year when Michelle Wolf dared to compliment the eyeshadow of Sarah Huckabee Sanders. But I'm just curious what you guys think about that event in general and the future of that event, because it is an example of, you know, comedy and politics sort of meeting head on. And we know some writers from other shows who've written for, wrote for Michelle Wolf this year.
We know writers from like all the shows. we're like so cool.
But anyway, do you think the press secretary is going to show up next year? Do you think it's going to happen? Like, has Trump just effectively ended this tradition?
I wouldn't say that Trump has ended it. I think the White House Correspondents Association ended it. They apologized for Michelle. That is unprecedented. Like, comedians making fun of powerful people is very precedented. We've been doing that since fucking Commedia dell'arte. It is unprecedented for them to be like, oh, we're sorry we roasted you when we threw a roast. That's insane. So maybe they shouldn't do it anymore. If they're afraid of having a roast and what a roast means, then like maybe that event shouldn't happen. It feels new, but it's actually not, because this has been going on. This happened during slavery. It happened during civil rights movement, women's rights movement, that like, this treatment is okay for you, but it's not okay for me, is actually like a very historical thing. So to say, I want to be able to get up on stage and lie every day. I want to be able to put kids in cages. I want to tell Muslim people they can't come on vacation here. And in return, I need you to never make a joke about me. It's not a new thing. We need to like realize it for what it is, and maybe like don't apologize for what is. Anything that's peaceful, anything that doesn't involve violence is free speech, and that is how America works. And I know that saying that means also the people who tweet at me all day calling me a fat bitch, that's their free speech. They should be allowed to do that. I would go to court for their right to do that as long as it doesn't involve violence. And when we start apologizing, oh, I'm sorry she told a joke about you, we're giving up a right and getting nothing in return for it.
I think also that dinner is like that. What happened there was so performative. Everybody, they knew Michelle was going to make those jokes. They were so excited to get those ratings. The reporters were so excited to be able to say to tisk tisk and say, oh, Sarah Huckabee Sanders deserves our respect, because they wanted to make sure that, because she's one of their sources, they want to make sure that she's pleased with it. The conservatives were so excited to be able to say, like, look at what they've done to our beautiful Sarah Huckabee Sanders. It's so performative that it's, I would be very happy if the dinner never happens again. The whole thing is a very disgusting display of access journalism at its worst to me, and I would be very happy if Michelle killed that whole thing.
Ooh, that got some applause.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, like, what the only thing they're celebrating, and again, this actually gets back to the civility thing, because a lot of elite media jumped in on this civility conversation. People like pundits on CNN being like, you know, talking about like, is the era of civility over now? Like, is the, you know, and this is a perfect example of it. Like, the White House Correspondents' Dinner is a perfect example of the deference to power and why elite media were so interested in the civility conversation, because they often dine with these people. They're often in the same places as these people. They also want to be immune often from the consequences of real decisions that these people make that actually have effects on millions of people's real lives. So, like, they're all sort of like, they were all complicit in that together, which is why, of course, then suddenly, like, a CNN anchor is like, shouldn't we be more polite to people in restaurants, even if they're jailing children? Like, so So it's a perfect example of that, and I completely agree with Rubin. If she killed it, that would be a great act of mercy. And it's so preposterous that they were in any way appalled at what she did. Anyone who has ever seen Michelle's jokes and her set knows that that was what she was going to do. They knew that. They asked her to do it.
She also didn't... I thought it was ridiculous. She didn't comment on her appearance in a negative way. You know, it was very smart, what she said. I do think, too, that it's you know, it's difficult because there aren't conservative comedians. Maybe Greg Gutfeld would disagree because he thinks he's one. but there aren't. And so I feel like all the comedy is, you know, pointed towards the people who are in power who happen to be Trump people. And so there's this false narrative of like, well, it's only one-sided. It's only this way. You know, it's not on the other side. It's like, well, the other side, A, isn't in power. And B, not very funny, right? Right, guys? Right?
I do think, like, it must suck. There aren't very many conservative comedians. There are some, like, very apolitical comedians, but people are becoming more political. And so if you're conservative and you're like, there's no comedy for me, that sucks. Comedy is great. Everyone should have some. That being said, comedy has always been about speaking truth to power, and so our power structure happens to be like a white supremacist patriarchy, so that's what we're gonna punch at. That's what comedy is. There are apolitical comedians, though, that I love, and you should watch them and not be sad, because comedy's great. I don't know. For all the conservatives listening to this podcast.
I was just gonna plug Hannah Gadsby's Netflix special. I think that's a really good example of someone that, I wasn't super familiar with her politics, but just her story is really interesting, and it starts off sort of non-political, and then it becomes political just through her story and her life. And it's really, really, really good, so I highly recommend that. Plus, I just, going back to the white patriarchy, it is nice to see diversity of thought in this world, and politics generally is a bunch of white dudes, especially now. So it is nice to see other people's perspectives on that, because we always hear the white male perspective, so it's nice to hear that. I like hearing women and people of color being funny. That's me.
Since this is a panel at the Delclos Marathon, and there might be some comedy writers or aspiring comedy writers in the audience or listening to this, also wanted to ask you guys if you had any advice for people who were looking to get into political comedy or writing for late night shows, and what you think sort of maybe what your path was, if you think it's typical, or what you think, what advice you would give to somebody who's 22 or, you know, just starting out and wants your job one day.
I have an advice. Start doing the job now. Don't wait to get it. I think a lot of, especially writers, sometimes people become writers because they're shy. So like someday someone will hire me to write and then I'll start writing jokes. Just start doing it. When I was in Chicago, my dream at the time was to write for SNL. So me and my girlfriends rented out a theater and put on like a bootleg SNL every week. So every week we wrote sketches and we practiced for the job that we wanted to have. And renting that theater, I think, was like $200 a week. And we could scrape that together. And I maybe paid it off after I got the job at Sambi. but people could come and see that show. And we would post clips online. And we would tweet about it and blah, blah, blah. And then when I was finally in the arena where I was like getting packets for these writing jobs, I say, oh, I used to be the head writer of Just Great in Chicago. And no one's in Chicago. So they're like, it must have been a huge show. For like legit, that's how I've gotten everything I've ever gotten, is like bootleg ass hustle. I got my acting agent because me and my girlfriends put together a showcase of women, and we stole, a friend of ours worked at a theater, and that theater had a list of every casting director and agent in town, and we stole it and invited them all. And it was like, oh, you have my personal contact information, you must be important. And they showed up and watched the showcase, and that's how we all got agents. Don't wait to get the job. Give it to yourself and just do it and invite people to it.
And steal email addresses and misrepresent your resume.
Yes.
Yeah, Ashley is absolutely right that, like, you have to be... People are not going to think about you as a writer just because you happen to meet them somewhere and give them a resume. They have to be excited about some piece of work you've done. That's the only, I think a lot of people think that they can come up to television writers or agents and managers and just say, like, here, I'm interested in being a writer, so can I have my writing job now? And they forget that, like, everybody who is working in the business has a bunch of friends. They themselves want to get up into the business with them because they're very excited having worked with them for years. And the only way you can get into those ranks is by impressing people with your comedy work, not not the fact that you know them, not the fact that you love the work they do. They have to be excited about comedy work you have done. So just keep producing comedy as much as you can in any format you can to get their attention.
All of that is the best advice that you can get. I guess the only thing I would add is, like, just do all the things that you like and are good at as much as you can, and then see which of them works out. Until I had this job, did comedy stuff at UCB and was on teams and stuff, but also did, like, day jobs that weren't comedy jobs, and they just sort of led to where I am now.
Well, yeah, you guys all, because you're all writing comedy, political comedy, I think it's interesting, Zubin, you were a lawyer, you went to law school, and I think that helped your trajectory in a way. Hopefully you paid off. And then you have a master's degree, right? Ashley has a master's degree, and Sal was actually a producer for Chris Hayes, and yeah. Also some. Did you? Oh, and Steve Kornacki.
Yes.
No. Yeah, and Steve Kornacki as well. So, you know, I think, like, finding your voice, like finding what you're interested in, and also doing comedy, but doing it in that direction too. It's really important.
One more really important thing. Also, like, have health insurance. Like, I think people think, like, oh, I'm going to get the smallest job possible so I can spend all my time on comedy. But if you are not taking care of yourself, you're having a hard time paying rent and you don't have health insurance, actually, you can't make great comedy. So get a 40-hour-a-week job, make comedy on nights and weekends, have health insurance. Yes.
Let's put an end to those Kickstarters for people's health insurance.
Well, yeah, I think we can all agree. Let's all get healthcare. Sign up for Obamacare before they kill it. On that note, we have to wrap up the panel. Our time is up. This show will be released on the Two Beers In podcast. So if you're not familiar with our podcast, subscribe to it. If some of you guys are in from out of town for the Del Close Marathon and you can't come to our monthly show at UCB, you can listen to it because we put the show up every week and we always have terrific comedy writers like these folks here on the show. And it's even more exciting because we're tipsy.
Yeah, we're drunk. And we talk about hot takes. So thank you so much to Ashley Nicole Black, Zubin Parang, and Sal Gentile.
And we also want to thank our producer, Sophie. This is her last day working for UCB Comedy, so give it up for Sophie.
Yeah, thank you, Sophie.
And all of you, please don't forget to vote in midterm elections. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Cody and Charlie and a few of their friends chug a couple of beers and talk politics. It's better when you're two beers in.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.